Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, I have the privilege of welcoming back Camille to the show. Camille has been on before, and she's a young woman that embraced a non-binary identity and went under the knife in 2020 to have her breasts removed. If you missed our first conversation, I do encourage you to go back and have a listen as Camille talks about her very personal story in that episode, and we're not going to go through that again today. So now, after addressing her physical and mental health issues, Camille embraces her life as a woman, and she's speaking out to help others. Camille, thank you so much for coming back on Venus Rising with me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Callie.
Yeah. So in our first episode, like I said, we talk a lot about your personal story, and we're not going to go back through all those details again. So we talked about why you thought you were non-binary and the discomfort that you had with your own body and why you had your breasts removed. And we talked about a lot about your path to healing, which was really encouraging to hear. And so again, I'm going to encourage folks who haven't listened to that to go back and have a listen. But today I want our focus to start on your work with advocating for others who are being led down the path that you once were with gender affirmation treatment. And you recently gave testimony in Oregon and South Dakota. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the background of what legislation's happening in our states, why it's important that folks like you are telling your story and testifying, and a little bit about your experience testifying?
Right. So I first testified in Florida, and that was important because I know that the stories of detransitioners, because I think there is seven or nine of us, I can't remember the number, but there's quite a few of us who had gone to Florida, and it was the biggest group of detransitioners testifying at that time. And so it was important because what had happened was that our testimonies did impact the decision. And so when you hear Dr. Patrick Hunter's speech, it's very obvious that what our stories had impacted that. And so it is so important for detransitioners to have our stories heard and to kind of, you know, go out there and tell our stories so that people understand, like, this is what's happening and this is how we prevent it. But yeah, so I went to Florida. I've done, I testified, and that was for the Florida Board of Medicine. And then I've testified for and against some Senate bills, and that would be South Dakota, Montana, and then recently in Oregon. So
it's busy. Yeah. Lots of traveling.
It is busy.
Are you showing up in person?
Yes. So I am showing up in person for all the ones I listed. I try to do one, but that's kind of the tricky thing, is that sometimes they won't allow online testimony. So, I have submitted some, what do they call them? Like, I've submitted like written testimony as well. So yeah.
Equally as important. Mm-hmm. So give us a breakdown of maybe the most recent one in Oregon. Like, what are you speaking up? Are you trying to, like, what's the goal of you sharing your testimony? What law is at stake here?
So a lot of these, not particularly the one in Oregon, but many of these have been for children transitioning. And so Oregon was the first one that would be in relation to adults. So it was actually adults in conversion therapy. And the problem with conversion therapy is that we can all agree that the conversion therapy that uses emotional and physical abuse is wrong. But the problem is that when they don't allow people to question, because that would be considered transphobic, like the therapist to explore with the patient that, you know, like, let's look into this. Let's just make sure that you aren't trans, you know, that sort of thing is so important, and that the concern is that a bill like this passing would not allow therapists to question their patients and to explore with their patients, which would be horrific. Like, that's going to cause a lot of problems. And so I testified because, especially as an adult who transitioned, this bill would impact someone like me. The reality is that it most likely impacted me as well, because I mean, it's difficult to say, like, which therapist, you know, if a therapist doesn't feel like they can say something, then that's a problem, because you're not allowing to be critical about it. You're not allowing to explore with the patient what may be the underlying issue, which, as we discussed in the last video, was around, you know, a history of trauma around my sexuality and being a woman. So it's deeply concerning.
Right. So this bill in Oregon would say you are not allowed to be critical of why, you know, I've talked with others about ACEs and the effect of trauma. And so you wouldn't even be able to explore that. You just really would basically be ushering children and adults into transitioning, no matter what. If they wanted to transition, then they would basically be escorted by their therapist down that road.
Yeah, like, that is exactly right. And so the thing is that they're not seeing that. Like, I do know a lot on the, I can't remember if it was the House committee or the subcommittee. I can't remember which committee exactly introduced this bill. But what had happened was that, you know, a lot of these members are gay. And so they're coming from the perspective of this horrible, you know, and maybe some of them did have an experience with conversion therapy. So they're coming from that, but they're not thinking about that there needs to be this sort of exploration. And one of them thought too that, oh, this, you know, you're just kind of over exaggerating things. Like, that's what one of the committee members kind of implied through his speech at the very end. Mm-hmm. And so it is really concerning, because they don't realize that, yes, this is going to have a huge impact on everyone. And yeah, and so I'm hoping that it doesn't go through, but given that it's Oregon, there is a chance that it could, just because, and that's the unfortunate aspect of it, is that this ideology does influence people and doesn't allow them to think about things critically. Even though we have all these gay board members, when you look at stories like Richie, you know, someone who, for those of you who don't know, Richie is gay, and he had a lot of discomfort around that, and he transitioned, and now he has this botched bottom surgery. And it's just, when you've heard his story, it's just horrific what he's gone through and like what he has to go through because of this. And so it is impacting gay people as well. And that is a concern, because they're just not getting it, because they're still kind of stuck in that mindset of, you know, conversion therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. I had the opportunity to interview Richie, and he was still going under his handle on Twitter as Tulip. And so I'd encourage listeners to go back and hear his story, and you can find it all over and find him on Twitter as well. But yeah, it is, he's now suing as well. Yeah. For the care he received. And I understand that you're also doing that. We don't have to talk about that, because I don't want to impede any of your lawsuit. But I think Jennifer and I are writing a book that is kind of a spinoff, sharing the stories that we talk about in our newest film, The Detransition Diary, Saving Our Sisters. And that book is going to come out this year. And we talk a lot about the tides turning and what it's going to cause, how can we turn this bus around? And and I think part of it is lawsuits from folks like you, unfortunately, folks like Richie, and then your testimony, because you can't hush a personal story. You can't, you know, it happened to you. And how does that feel to have to go in and kind of relive and reshare your story every time?
It's hard, and it's something I'm not super comfortable with. I know. I think it's one thing to kind of talk one-on-one with somebody. And I know that it's kind of interesting with these sort of podcasts, because it's like one-on-one, but it's really, you're seeing a whole audience is seeing it, but it's really surreal to do that in front of a group of people. And you don't know too how the other person's going to react. Like in Oregon, their response to testimonies like mine were very insensitive. Like they were just like pretty much gaslighting us and saying it was like, you know, this is not, I don't think this is a concern, you know, and they were talking about, they would just talk about how proud they were to be gay and such. And it was the sort of weird virtue signaling that was happening from the committee. And it's really difficult because when you're up there, you're reliving your trauma, you know, over and over and over again. And even though I'm fairly stable right now, it's still emotionally difficult to go up there and talk about the most vulnerable, embarrassing part of my life, which was, you know, dealing with all this trauma around being a woman and around sexuality, and then having this surgery, which was a mistake that I can never go back on. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, telling people about my breasts, which is something I don't like talking about either, but people need to hear about that this is happening and that this is a serious issue. And that's why I keep doing this, is because it is so important. Like even with like what's going on with how this committee reacted to me, I'm willing to go up there because, and deal with responses like that, because this is wrong and I don't want this to happen to somebody else. So.
Well, and I just applaud you and everyone else, because I know it's, actually, I don't know. That's acting like I know. Yeah. It can be scary anytime to share a personal story. And I don't know how you feel doing that, but I applaud you and all of the others who are willing to go out on the limb, because this is so concerning. And so I just want to take a second and say that I appreciate you, and I appreciate the folks who are willing to do this. You have a unique perspective that needs to be heard. And we talked a little bit on the last episode about informed consent and research, and how, you know, it's interesting that as a minority of group of detransitioners, how quickly society kind of wants to hush them, even though we talk about mm-hmm. the importance of minority groups. This is one minority group right. that's being silenced, and they're falling off of research. They're falling out of studies, and just kind of the confounding effect of like, if they're not in studies, then how can we truly give informed consent to those who are trying to quote unquote transition or go on hormones or have surgery? So would you like to talk a little bit more about in the last episode, you talked about how there really was a lack of informed consent. So would you elaborate more on that and your experience?
Sure. So I think one of the things too is talking about studies. I don't know how many studies there are on transitioning to a non-binary surgery. Like how many studies are out there saying that we know this is successful, we know that this high, like we know that detransition for this isn't high. Like I don't think that there's really any studies on particularly non-binary transition.
And we talked about last time, we don't even know what non-binary is. Like, what does that look right? like? It's just a made up thing, right?
Right. Well, it's so surreal because you have the idea of non-binary being on the spectrum, or like in this, I guess, center of the spectrum, like anywhere on the spectrum, outside of the spectrum, like gender spectrum. It's bizarre because there isn't like something we can pinpoint to, yes, this is non-binary. It's consistently non-binary. And yeah, it's surreal because what's happening is that doctors, like, and surgeons and these therapists are all on board with this, and there's nothing to transition to. Like, we can't be like, well, hey, like, here's a non-binary sex, like, let's transition you to this, but there's no third sex, right? But there's nothing there. So it's, the whole thing is surreal that it's, you know, it's getting through like this. And it just shows that there's like an ideological bent, which, you know, medicine should never be influenced by ideology.
Okay. So we talk about informed consent and all of those components that must be met. And I just get really concerned in adults, and especially in children, that they are truly able to have decision-making capacity. They might be being treated for something else. They might have trauma that's kind of clouding their judgment. And in your case, you were undergoing therapy for other things right before your surgery. So do you think that adults in this situation and children are able to truly give consent and have proper like decision-making capacity?
I don't. I think that part of it too is that like you're saying, I was doing transcranial magnetic stimulation therapy, and that's it's a cousin to electroconvulsive therapy, but much safer. But that's the sort of treatment that you administer to somebody who can't take medications, who've failed other forms of treatment for things like major depressive disorder, which I was also struggling with. So it's, unfortunately, I mean, I was struggling with all these mental health issues, and I was like, I was actually, I talked to my doctor about getting the top surgery while I was doing TMS. So like, I'm doing this very more severe, I don't know how you describe it, but it's a more severe treatment. It's a, like kind of like a last resort treatment. So I'm doing that, and I'm requesting this surgery because I think that's going to help me. It's just a lot of these people are not in the right mental state to consent to a surgery like this. They're struggling emotionally, and they're being told that, well, if you only had the surgery, then you would feel better. And that's unfortunately with the idea of, well, would you rather have a trans son instead of a dead girl or something like that, mm-hmm. right?
And so a that's live son or a dead daughter, that kind of emotional right. blackmail.
Really. Right. Yeah. And it's so unfortunate because it is this lie that's being told out there that, well, it's because this patient is so dysfunctional that they need a transition. And instead of, well, maybe there's a underlying issue that needs to be addressed. Like, how are they health-wise? Like, because I know with some of the individuals, they'll do therapy and it works great for them. I know with my particular case, it was a physical issue, but you need to be stable before you do any sort of surgery like this. And that was not done with me. It was, they allowed me to go through this, even though I was emotionally unstable and dysfunctional.
Right. And we're not talking like full stop. Like, we are not talking about surgeries that are uncomplicated, minimally invasive, outpatient, right. just like on the surface. And we're not talking about surgeries that can be reversed. Like, these are life-altering surgeries. Girls are mm-hmm. having their uteruses or uteri removed, you know, and that can't yeah. be reversed. And they are infertile, mm-hmm. going on cross-sex hormones. Some call them the wrong sex hormones. There are lasting consequences to this. And I just like full stop. I don't think that people who aren't in on this or who don't have a dog in this fight are thinking about, because like you said, there's this like emotional blackmail of this suicide issue. People mm-hmm. think, oh, well, we got to save their lives. And of course we don't want kids committing suicide, but we've shown that that's not happening. And it's blackmail for a physician or for a therapist to say that to parents. So while we're talking about the effects of these surgeries, can you talk a little bit now about your concern for folks who have these surgeries and then decide later, however long it takes? We talked in our first interview about sometimes that can be years, or, you know, they're still having issues. Can you talk though about kind of reproductive regret or the long-term consequences?
Right. So for me, I would like to have children. This is, and it's so, what's sad about this is that this was something I had no interest in for the longest time. Like, I did not have interest until probably this or last year was when and that was after I detransitioned, was mm-hmm. when I realized that, oh, I actually do want a family. I do want to have kids. And what's sad is that, you know, a lot of these kids are getting, you know, like you're saying, their uterus removed, and they haven't grown to the point where these girls are going to realize that, oh, I actually do want a family and I can't have my own kids because that's been taken from me. And it's so frustrating because it's, I mean, the whole system is just frustrating. I know that with right, like the whole medical system is frustrating. And I remember, slightly off topic, but I was having these heavy irregular periods, and it was painful. I just, that's why I was like on the pill for the longest time. And my gynecologist said to me that, well, there's this procedure that you can do, and it will destroy the lining of your uterus, and then you won't have issues with periods anymore. And I heard that, and I was like, this doesn't feel right to me. And I think that, from my understanding, that would have destroyed my chances of ever having kids, or have a good chance of it. And I'm so glad I didn't do it, because I actually, after addressing my physical health issues, then the irregular periods got more regular, then the cramping went away, and now I have regular flow. And so it's sad, because sometimes there's a simpler way to address this than this radical thing. And we're seeing this too with the trans issue, is that, well, let's try everything first that's non-invasive instead of this, because now I do want a family and I can never breastfeed my kids. And, you know, then it's just, it's not only like that sort of intimacy between, you know, me and a child, but it's also that now I'm having to go out and buy some sort of formula, or, you know, I'm trying to look at a natural thing, because I don't really want to do like baby formula. So I'm trying to see what other natural things, but that's something I have to think about. Like, I can't do it myself. I have to now rely on an outsource, like to outsource it to a kid or to my kids. And it's so frustrating, because it just, I think back about how dysfunctional I was, and it's bizarre that they said okay to that. Like, they, yeah, it's
right. Yeah. Sigh is right. Uh-huh. It frustrates me as well. And being at the Center for Bioethics and Culture, we have our finger on the pulse of this, and also big fertility. And I call the big fertility like big pharma, you know, people who are trying to exploit reproduction and women's bodies. And it's like they kind of feed into one another. Firsthand, we have children who are undergoing, I'm going to put this in air quotes, but transition, mm-hmm. medically transitioning, and they're rendered infertile. And they're asked, and this is in our first film on this topic, transmission, what's the rush to reassign gender, where we talk about how kids are offered fertility preservation. You know, they can save their sperm or their eggs before they undergo medically transitioning. Mm-hmm. And so they're like signed up for big fertility from the start, which is a huge money-making industry, exploitive industry. And like it's, as a nurse, you know, I'm a perinatal nurse, and it is so important, like skin to skin, that golden hour. We teach in California, baby friendly across the United States. That's becoming, you know, all these hospitals are becoming certified in baby friendly, which is skin to skin and breastfeeding, and educating moms on that. And it's like, wait a second. So now we're just chopping off breasts because that's okay. Like, what happened to, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I find myself sighing like we just did, and frustrated.
Right. Yeah. And it's just kind of the sad thing too, of that. I think it's like when women get older, they want to have kids, but not necessarily when they're younger. Yeah. And so that's the thing, is that like I said, I had no interest. And then all of a sudden I started having an interest in having a family. And, you know, I mean, too, there's the reproductive part. There's also the sexual intimacy with my husband sort of thing, mm-hmm. or future husband, hopefully. But yeah, but it is like there is this intimacy that I can never have as well. And I've never had. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that was the thing too. I never had that sort of intimacy with somebody before, and now I'm never going to have it. Yeah. And that's something that people need to hear, is that that is an aspect. It's not just a body part that can just be lopped off. It's like, this is functional, and right. It's being removed without a full understanding of the consequences in order to protect like a perceived minority. Right. And the thing is too, is that I think about, there's this talk about like, well, it's trans, we know it's protect trans people, But there's, you know, women with mental illness that are struggling and need help, and they're not getting the help they need. And so it just, I mean, it's really unfortunate because it's not looking at things critically. It's just looking at through, well, we must protect this one class of people, and then everybody else doesn't matter to them, unfortunately.
Grace talks a lot about that in our film, Detransition Diary, Saving Our Sisters, about she also had top surgery and is married now. And she talks about the consequences of that. And she also didn't think she wanted children, and now she does. And I'm flabbergasted that that's, you know, we're offering fertility preservation to these kids, because when you look at the graph or the reasons why or why they didn't choose to do it, I'm like, I wanted 5 children when I was 9, and they were all going to have names starting with V. You know, like, we come up with all kinds of things when we're young. We can't make those decisions. Again, talking about informed consent, there's no decision-making capacity there, you know? So coming first full circle with that, you said something that sparked a light in my head there at the end. And trying to go back there. Now I'm having a brain fart of my own. You talked about, I was thinking while you were talking about something that you tweeted recently, the commodification of trauma, and how they want to protect a minority, but there's also money to be made through this, right? And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there also was just recently an article that came out kind of exposing Rachel Levine in this. And the commodification and the price tag that it's attached to this minority of people that's having gender dysphoria or who want to medically transition. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways that trauma has been commodified, and kind of like, I feel that there's definitely a sort of pull from different political parties and like using detransitioners or transitioners to like kind of uplift themselves, sort of thing. Part of it was like, when I wrote that tweet, I was thinking about how when I testify, like, I'm having to relive my trauma, and there is a sort of and then being also treated as an adult detransitioner. I know that one of the, I was talking to a member of one of these organizations, and they said, you know, that this is wrong, that this is happening to kids, and that this, you know, they're not able to make an informed decision, and that they're relying on adults to do that for them. And so they said that, and then they said, but I think adults need to be able to make dumb decisions. And it was so, it was one of those things that I felt uncomfortable, because I testified and give this really emotional testimony earlier that day. And it was just sort of surreal, because, you know, I'm living this trauma, and I'm talking about it and trying to get this to stop happening from others. And then, you know, as an adult, you get treated a little bit differently. But it's sort of like, as a human being, you don't necessarily get, you're more there just so that you have this testimony that you can give people. And it was just kind of surreal, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like, you're willing to go out on a limb, share your story.
Yeah.
In front of people, be critiqued and judged or whatever. And then this person is saying, nope, adults should just be able to make dumb decisions. But we talked previously, before we started airing this show or this episode, about how really that doesn't work in this situation. Because, like you talked about, these are adults who might have unresolved trauma, unresolved mental and physical health issues. These are adults that, like, we should still be concerned for adults, you know?
Yeah.
We should have protections in some, you know, against some of these dumb decisions. It's not a free pass. And we talked before we started airing about the consequences of that argument of allowing adults to make dumb decisions. And that's putting men in spaces where women should feel safe and they don't anymore. That's putting men in women's prisons. That's putting boys in girls' locker rooms. And that's not okay. Well, I think that we are getting close to our time here. And I appreciate you coming on to Venus Rising to talk again and give us a little update about what you've been doing. And I just want to applaud your efforts and all of those who are sharing, whether it's a detransitioner who's unfortunately been through this and has a personal story, or if it's those who are helping protect population at large, whether it's therapists, doctors, those who are going on and testifying. We're kind of seeing the United States becoming a patchwork of laws and legislation, Florida upholding one end of the spectrum, and California and Oregon on the very opposite. So we'll be following this. We'll be seeing what happens. But again, Camille, thank you for the work that you're doing to protect others. Is there anything else that you'd like to end with before we say our goodbyes?
Yeah, I guess I would just like to say that I'm going to continue to testify, and it's just super important because they just need to hear. And I know that states like Oregon and California are going to be more difficult, but, you know, even though like this, I don't think that we were successful in Oregon this last time, we're going to keep at it, and we're going to figure out how to, you know, let people know that even in these, you know, far left states, how this has impacted us and why it is so important that we address this differently. So,
and how can people help you? How can people who hear your story and want to somehow do something, what can they do?
So one thing is I actually do have a GiveSendGo for my lawsuit. And so I don't think we talked about it that much today, but yeah, I have a lawsuit going against the two mental health professionals who approved of my non-binary double mastectomy. So that would be a great way to support me and the lawsuit. And other than that, people can find me on Twitter at Get Better Tweets or the Get Better Researcher on YouTube. And I have like an all my links that has all my social media profiles. And so people can find me there.
Yeah, we will include that in the memo of this podcast so people can find you. Absolutely. And like I said earlier in today's episode, that lawsuits like yours, I believe, are going to help change things. They're going to turn the tides. That's what it's going to take. So folks who are following Camille and her story, you can support her lawsuit, so that we can begin to turn this over, turn this bus around. But thank you again for coming on the show today and again being willing to just be vulnerable with us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Like I said, you can find Camille on Twitter with the handle Get Better Tweets. I'd also like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in. Our goal is, as ever, to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage everyone to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.